What have you lost that you would dearly love to have back? For some of you, that might be a car that you had long ago that was the perfect vehicle and you've never been able to find one quite like it. For others, perhaps it's a pet who died that you had for a while and loved very much. For many of us, the answer is a person, a grandparent, a parent, a child. In some cases, perhaps it's not death that separates you, but a fight, a dispute, bitterness and anger. But you too want so badly to have that person back without the anger, without the bitterness any longer. Regardless of whether it's a death or anger that separates you, what would you do to have that person back? Would you do anything? Today's text gives us an example of this. After 22 years of thinking that his favorite son, Joseph, is dead, Jacob finds out that Joseph is alive. And not only is his long-lost son alive, that son invites him to come to Egypt and live with him. And not only does he invite him to come to live with him in Egypt, but that son is the second most powerful person in the kingdom of Egypt. And so he's invited to come and live very comfortably in the presence of this son whom he loves. Jacob wants to see Joseph more than he wants anything else in the world. And he starts to go. But then he pauses and he asks the question, am I disobeying God and going to my son? What do I want more, Joseph or God? Recall in last week's text that Joseph had revealed himself to his brother. That's where we left him last week. Convinced that they were repentant of their actions of selling him into slavery 22 years before, he tells them he's the very brother that they sinned against. And they feared, but he forgives them. Why? Because he sees that God is sovereign, that God's in control of all things, that God had planned to get Joseph to Egypt, and Joseph had to go to Egypt. And so all of his suffering was not pointless, but the suffering was used by God to bless Egypt, and indeed to bless the very brothers who had sinned against him. Well, anxious to see his father, Joseph twice tells his brother, hurry, hurry, go back, tell my father, bring him here, hurry. There are 5 more years of famine, and Joseph wants the entire family to come to Egypt, and he promises to provide for them and take care of them. Well, today's text shows the fulfillment of that, including the prospering of the Israelites in Egypt and the prospering of the Egyptians because of God's blessings on them through Israel. We're going to look briefly at that overall story, and the economist in me can't help calling that the macro picture, the big picture of what's going on. But then we're going to zoom in on Jacob's question. Is he to give up this opportunity to see this beloved son of his in order to walk with God? Should he go to Egypt? So that'll be our micro focus, our smaller focus towards the end. We'll see how Jacob answers that question, and then we'll ask ourselves similar questions. So first, the big picture, the Israelites going to Egypt with blessings. As Tyrone just read for us, our passage begins with Pharaoh himself inviting Joseph's brothers and his entire family to come to Egypt. He actually commands Joseph to send wagons to get the men and women and children. Now, wagons doesn't sound too elegant to us, but remember, this is Egypt. when Egypt is the richest country in the world. Think of the pictures you've seen, or perhaps the actual objects you've seen that have come from some of the tombs of Egyptian kings. When Pharaoh says, "Send my wagons to get them," what we need to hear is, "Send a limo to get them." That's the equivalent today. Pharaoh is sending the richest, most ornate vehicles that he has to go bring Joseph's family to Egypt. So yeah, a big stretch limo, several of them, to go and bring these 66 people to Egypt. Joseph even says, "Forget about your goods." Pharaoh says, "Forget about your goods. We'll take care of you. Just bring what you need for the trip." And so Joseph sends the limos or wagons, and with those, he sends a present for his father, donkeys, gifts, provisions for the journey, and he even gives gifts to his brothers, the very brothers who had sinned so greatly against him. The greatest gift is for Benjamin, but all of them receive gifts. And then he tells them, don't quarrel. Did you catch that? Don't quarrel on the way. Why does he say that? Certainly they have a history of quarreling, and that's part of it. But remember, the brothers now have to tell the story of what they've seen in Egypt. They have to tell the story of Joseph being exalted. They have to tell the story of Joseph being alive. And they have a role in that, don't they? They have to tell their own story. They have to confess to their father for the first time, "Father, we threw Joseph in the pit. We sold him into slavery. We're the reason that Joseph went to Egypt." And confessing will provide them with the opportunity of arguing who's really responsible for this. Remember, back in chapter 42, when the brothers were feeling guilty, when they knew that they were going to have to leave Simeon in Egypt, Reuben piped up and said, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy?" And so Joseph can imagine these types of arguments going on. Who's going to take the blame for sending Joseph to Egypt? And he says, "Don't fight. You're forgiven. You're forgiven. Confess. Don't fight about it. Don't make excuses. Just tell our father what's happened. I'm alive. You all are coming to Egypt as one forgiven, unified family." So that's what they do. The text doesn't give us any details about those interactions, their confession, but they tell their father with rejoicing that Joseph is alive. So the confession, I believe, is sincere and complete, without recriminations against each other. And then later on, we'll look at Jacob's response to that news. Well, all of the household goes to Egypt, verses 8 to 27 of chapter 46, lists many, many names. We won't go through all of those. But Joseph, having achieved his goal of getting his family into Egypt, now wants them not just anywhere in Egypt. He wants them to be in the land of Goshen. It's good land, good pasture land, that's one reason. But he also wants them to be there because in that land they'll be isolated somewhat from Egyptian society. So Joseph wants Pharaoh to assign the land of Goshen. Pharaoh has promised good land, but Joseph wants Pharaoh to assign them to this particular land. So he tells his brothers what to say to Pharaoh, and they do. They go along with Joseph's plans very well, and Pharaoh assigns the land of Goshen to them and even tells Joseph to take the most skilled of his brothers and make them responsible for Pharaoh's cattle. And then Joseph brings Jacob in to bless Pharaoh. I want to read these verses, verses 7 to 10 of chapter 47. Then Joseph brought in Jacob his father and stood him before Pharaoh. Pharaoh now is the most powerful man in the world. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many are the days of the years of your life? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh. How does Jacob come before this powerful king? The brothers came with a request. The brothers came asking Pharaoh to give them the land of Goshen. But the heir of the promise of Abraham, Jacob, the one through whom all the nations will be blessed, does not come to Pharaoh as a supplicant. He does not come to Pharaoh asking for a boon from him. He instead is the source of blessing for Pharaoh. Now, when Pharaoh asks about his age, Jacob almost sounds gloomy. Is he telling the truth? It is true that Jacob does not reach the age of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham lived to be 175, Isaac 180. Jacob is now 130, will live until he's 147. And it is true also that his life has been characterized by conflict. Remember, with his brother Esau, with Laban, with his own sons, with his wives. God has redeemed it. God has redeemed that conflict and used all of that greatly for his purposes and for his glory. But the days have been difficult. Well, as God's source of blessing to all nations, Jacob blesses this pagan king two times in verse 7 and verse 10. Now, we tend to think of the words, well, bless you as some sort of greeting, and that blessings don't really follow that. Do blessings follow Jacob's statement to Pharaoh? The rest of the section, chapter 47, verses 11 to 27, displays the blessings that do follow. The blessings on the people of Israel and the blessings on Pharaoh. First, let's look at Israel. Verse 27. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen. And they gained possessions in it and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. Indeed, right now there are 70 people. Over the next 400 years, this large household will become more than 2 million people by the time of Moses and the Exodus. God blesses Israel greatly in Egypt. What about Pharaoh? God fulfills Jacob's blessings to Pharaoh through Jacob's son Joseph. The rest of this chapter tells us about the people of Israel running out of money and livestock, which they've given in exchange for food from Joseph. And so they voluntarily offer themselves and their land to Joseph, to Pharaoh, in exchange for food. Joseph agrees, and Pharaoh ends up with all of the land of Egypt except the land that belongs to the priests. And all the people other than the priests become servants of Pharaoh. And yet there's no animosity, quite the contrary. These people are very happy to get food in exchange for their freedom and in exchange for their land. And Pharaoh is the beneficiary of that. So God very clearly fulfills Jacob's blessing. Jacob blesses Pharaoh, and immediately the text talks about how Jacob is then, how Pharaoh is then blessed because of Jacob's blessing. Well, that's just a quick overview of the big picture. God has been at work from the beginning, from the fall, to build up a people for his own possession. And he had determined he was going to do that through the descendant of Abraham. And he wants a people who will be distinct from the nations around them, who will be devoted completely to him. And this step of bringing the Israelites to Egypt is a key step along that way. 400 years, they will remain in Egypt. And then Moses will lead them out as a large nation back to the promised land. But what had to happen in order for this big picture to be fulfilled? An important step along the way is Jacob's decision. Is he going to go to Egypt? So let's now focus in on that decision. So go back to Jacob, 130-year-old man sitting in Canaan, waiting for his sons to return. Remember, he didn't want to send Benjamin to Egypt. He wanted them to stay, he wanted Benjamin to stay right with him. He didn't want anything to happen to Benjamin. Because for 22 years, he thought that Joseph, Benjamin's older brother, was dead. For 22 years, he has mourned for Joseph. And so he sent Benjamin to Egypt against his will. Now imagine him sitting at home worrying. Is Benjamin going to come back? Is he okay? Or are all his fears going to be realized and he'll lose all of the children of Rachel? So he's not sleeping well. The brothers have been gone for weeks. Of course, there's no way for them to communicate with him. And he's worried about their return. And then he hears donkeys arriving. The sons have returned. And so he goes out to meet them. And there's Benjamin, healthy and well. Before he can even embrace him, the sons cry out, "Father, Father, Joseph is still alive. And he's ruler over all the land of Egypt." Think back to the question I asked you at the beginning. What do you want most? What do you miss most? Joseph was the one that Jacob missed more than anything and wanted more than anything else to have back in his life. Imagine that you heard that that person that you missed most alive and well, and you can see him or her. Wouldn't you go and run to them and see them as soon as you could? Wouldn't you travel however was necessary to get to the place where that person was? If you believed. But it could very well be that your first reaction would be what Jacob's is. Joseph alive? Is this just some sort of cruel joke? How can that be? How can that be? The brothers have to convince him that Joseph is alive. But they tell him the story. The text says they tell him all the words of Joseph. And of course, now they must confess their part in the story. And Jacob hears Joseph's God-centered words. "It was not your brothers who sent me here, but God." And he thinks, "Those indeed are the words of my son." Furthermore, he sees the limos or the wagons. And so he knows his sons did not buy these. And so he concludes in verse 28 of chapter 45, "It is enough. I've seen all the evidence I need. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. My son who was dead is alive again." Jacob loved Joseph and Benjamin more than anything after the death of Rachel. And he thought Joseph was gone forever and worried that Benjamin was lost too. And now in just a few minutes, he not only has Benjamin back, but he has the prospect of seeing his long-lost son. So they go on their way. They travel to the south. They reach the southernmost tip of the promised land, Beersheba. Later in the history of Israel, the expression "from Dan to Beersheba" will be used to mean all of Israel, from the northernmost to the southernmost tip of Israel. So they reach the southernmost tip. If they're going to keep traveling to Egypt, they're going to have to leave the promised land. They're going to have to leave the land of Canaan. And evidently, Jacob is beginning to doubt the wisdom of this trip. Because verse 3 of chapter 46 tells us He was afraid to go down to Egypt. What is he afraid of? We can speculate about many possible fears. The fear that Joseph is no longer the son he loved, the son he remembered. The fear of what Egypt will be like. But I don't think those are the main fears. I think the fundamental fear is that Jacob is afraid of disobeying God. The news that God has exalted Joseph from slavery to the number two position in Egypt has caused Jacob to remember the greatness of his God. Jacob had allowed the difficult circumstances of his life to overshadow his trust in God's sovereignty. But he knew God. Remember, he had spent a whole night wrestling with God, and then in the morning wouldn't let him go despite the fact that God had injured his hip. He knew that clinging to God was more important than resolving the issue with Esau. He knew that nothing in this life compared to holding on to God. Now, he had let that knowledge retreat into the background as he worried about Joseph, as he worried about Benjamin. But now, seeing God's great work, he's reminded, and he knows now that holding on to God is even more important than seeing his beloved son Joseph. He has a strong desire to see Joseph. He wants to see Joseph more than anything. But remember what God had done with Jacob's ancestors. God brought Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldeans, telling him, "Go to the land that I will show you." And Abraham went, not knowing where he was going, and went to Canaan. And after he had arrived there, chapter 12, verse 7, God says to him, "To your offspring I will give this land." And then Abraham made sure that the wife for his son Isaac, Jacob's mother, was not a Canaanite, but was from the land from which he had come, from his relatives, but he did not want to send Isaac back there to get her because he was afraid he might stay. So Abraham had gone to great lengths to make sure that his descendants remained in the land of Canaan, in the promised land. Remember, when Abraham's servant suggests that if the woman is unwilling to come back to Canaan, should he take Isaac with him there? And Abraham says, "By no means, do not do that. My son must remain in the promised land." Not only Abraham. God had told Jacob himself to leave his father-in-law's house and return to the land. Chapter 31, verse 3, God says to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you." And I think Jacob's remembering something else also. Jacob is facing a famine right now. Abraham faced a famine, do you remember? Back in chapter 12, God had sent him. He said, this is the land right here, Canaan. But then he was under pressure. A famine came to the land. And what did Abraham do? He went to Egypt. Because there's irrigated agriculture in Egypt with the big river flowing through the land. And he almost lost his wife in the process, remember? Abraham should never have gone to Egypt in that famine. It seemed to make sense from a human perspective, but it was wrong. So Jacob, now with his faith renewed, has to ask that question. It seems to make a lot of sense to go see Joseph in Egypt. But it seemed to make sense to my grandfather to go to Egypt in the midst of that famine. I don't want to disobey God. Not anymore. I've done enough of that in my life. I want to walk with God now at the end of my life. What should I do? And so in Beersheba, on the very altar probably that Abraham built and on which he had offered sacrifices, Jacob worships God. That's his task. Worship God and then see if God gives him direction. So that's what he does. God calls out to him in a night vision, Jacob, Jacob. And Jacob is listening and says, here I am. Verse 3 of chapter 46. Then God said, I am God, the God of your father. That is, I am the God of the covenant. I am the God who brought Abraham out of Ur. I am the God whom he disobeyed to go to Egypt. I am the God who will bring about the fulfillment of my plan to bless all the nations through you, Jacob. He says, do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. God had promised Abraham in chapter 12, verse 2, that he would make him a great nation. And God is now telling Jacob, I'm going to fulfill that promise through your descendants in Egypt. So I bless you. Go there. Verse 4. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. In Hebrew, there's a very strong emphasis on I, which is why the ESV translates that I myself. We could translate that whole verse, I, even I, will go down with you to Egypt, and I, even I, will bring you up again. God is saying, Jacob, there's no conflict between your desire to see Joseph and your fulfillment of my plans for you. I will fulfill both of those desires. Go. I am with you. And your beloved son Joseph will not only see you again, you will not only embrace him again, but he will be with you the rest of your life. So that when you die, he will be the one to close your eyes. Jacob acts very wisely here. He's willing to part with what he wants most on earth in order to serve God. He's living out Psalm 73. There's nothing on earth I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart, and God is my portion forever. Meanwhile, Joseph has been waiting anxiously for news of his father's arrival. He had told his brothers, hurry, but donkeys and wagons, even very elaborate wagons, can only move so fast. And Jacob had stopped at Beersheba. We don't know how long he was there. So weeks, maybe even months have passed since Joseph sent the brothers back to Canaan to get their father. Verse 29 of chapter 46. Then Joseph prepared his chariot when he heard the news that his father was in the land and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. Joseph prepared his own chariot, number two in Egypt, highly exalted, but he doesn't wait for the servants to do it. He hears his father has arrived, so he goes and hitches up the chariot himself and rides out to meet Jacob. Verse 29, and Joseph presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen your face and know that you are still alive. Jacob last saw Joseph when he was 17 years old, going out to seek his brothers dressed in his multicolored coat. And that image, that last image of Joseph must have stuck in his mind all those 22 years. And now he sees him not in a multicolored coat, but in the robe of a ruler of Egypt, not with the thin beard of a 17-year-old, but clean-shaven as the Egyptians. And there he is, his son, his beloved son, like he was raised from the dead. and Jacob is content. Jacob is content. Living with Joseph will be a joy, but now even dying, even death, holds no fear for him. Remember, it was just a few chapters ago that Jacob made quite a different statement about his death. When the brothers were telling him that they have to take Benjamin back to Egypt, and he said, "You're going to bring my head down to the grave in sorrow." 42 verse 36. "Benjamin will not go with you, for his brother is dead and he's the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, he would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol." Telling a different story now. It's through that very trip, through Benjamin's trip, that Jacob is now reunited not only with Benjamin, but also with Joseph. And he won't die in sorrow. Now he knows that he will die in with joy. So Joseph lived with Jacob the first 17 years of his life. And Jacob will live with Joseph the last 17 years of his life. Is this reunion with Joseph Jacob's greatest joy? Jacob knew it was not. At Beersheba, I believe Jacob was willing to give up this reunion. For despite the great joy of the reunion, Jacob knew a yet greater joy. The joy of knowing and following the God of the universe. The joy of fulfilling God's purpose for him in his life. Jacob knew this God to be the good and loving God who always keeps his promises. The merciful God Almighty who protected Joseph and miraculously exalted him. And Jacob knew that true joy can only be found in obedience to him. To disobey the source of all good gifts is to seek pain, not pleasure. Even if in the short run it gains some pleasure, like seeing the son that you love. So Jacob knows that his greatest joy comes from following God, from clinging to him. His greatest earthly joy, graciously granted by God, was to hold the son that had been raised to life. But having Joseph without God would be no gain for Jacob. Having Joseph with God is great gain indeed. What about you? Your purpose in life, like Jacob's, is to glorify your Creator. Your purpose in life is to show what He is like. Your purpose in life is to show that He's worth more than anything the world has to offer, even the restoration of a long-lost relationship. At Desiring God Community Church, we encourage people to pursue the greatest happiness. But the path to the greatest happiness can mean giving up lesser pleasures in order to achieve greater ones. The path to your greatest joy can be paved with saying no to what seems good. As we read earlier, Jesus tells his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up an instrument of execution, a cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will save it." The path to your greatest joy includes saying no to alternative pleasures. The path to your greatest joy includes denying yourself. The path to your greatest joy includes putting to death other desires that will distract you from the pursuit of God. If instead you try to hold on to what you think you need for joy in this life, you will lose, says Jesus. You will never gain the greatest joy of following Jesus. 17th century pastor named William Gurnall puts it this way: "A man never comes to enjoy himself truly in any comfort of his life till he is prepared to deny himself readily in it." Let me read that to you again. A man never comes to enjoy himself truly in any comfort of his life till he is prepared to deny himself readily in it. Are you prepared to deny yourself readily every comfort of your life? Jacob was willing to do that. And thus he was able to rejoice with great joy when God gave him Joseph. For you, what are those comforts? Your car, your house, your bank account, savings, probably more for most of us, jobs, our success, our position, our status, our children, our wife, our husband. God is not stingy. God is not stingy. He doesn't withhold something from you just out of meanness or out of trying to keep things to himself. If he withholds something from you, he does it for a purpose. If we give up a highly desirable joy, even our greatest earthly joy, as Jacob was willing to do, we do so knowing that God is going to give us an even greater joy. Once Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, we've given up everything to follow you." And he had. Gave up his profession. Gave up his home. Gave up his relatives. "We've left everything to follow you." Remember what Jesus said to him? Mark 10, 29 and 30. "Truly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel, who will not receive 100-fold now in this time houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life. A man never comes to enjoy himself truly in any comfort of this life till he is prepared to deny himself readily in it." That's what Jesus is saying in Mark 10, 29 and 30. If your possessions, friends, or family members are more important to you than God, if they have become idols to you, you will not enjoy them fully. You will not enjoy them truly. Indeed, those very idols will become for you the source of your greatest pain. Are you, like Jacob, willing to say no to the pleasures in order to pursue your greatest joy? Are you willing to say to God, "Earth has nothing I desire besides you. You are my portion forever"? Then, dying to self, you will be raised to life indeed. So die to self. Say no to pseudo pleasures and live in the greatest joy imaginable, intimacy with God.